Okay. So, bunch of announcements. Homework 3 solutions are now online, and the graded homework is returned. In general, homeworks are graded leniently. So, for example, if they are, if people interpreted some question wrongly, rather than give zeros, the TA winds up giving most of the marks. So, for example, I think in this particular one, more than, I think about three or four people interpreted the question of the number of models for the entire set of sentences as rather than each sentence separately. So I think one of the questions I gave different logical sentences and asked how many models does each have, and some people have just considered it as conjunction of it. To the extent you did that, that's fine. I mean, I think you mostly got the points anyway for those. So just don't assume just because you got pretty high marks that all your answers are right. Okay, look at the posted solutions because we may have given you the benefit of the, I mean, we may have been lenient in the homework. That's the whole point of homework, so that you fail fast and then we can test you separately. That's the whole point. Okay, homework 4 socket is opened and the project 3 socket is also opened. Project 3 has also been provided. So project 3 is essentially writing a little base network, and you use a base network tool of the same type from the same place where you looked at the constraint satisfaction tool. They have a base network tool, so you can specify a network and they'll do inference for you. Okay, so if you are sort of a domain modeler, all you care about this course is how to write a base network. So for example, in particular, today's class is something that you assume a tool does. Today's class we'll talk about how to do inference on the network. Okay, you assume some tool would do it. Okay, all you need as a domain a domain modeler is how to write what you know as a base network. Okay, so that's essentially what we'll make you and I'll make you do in this particular case. It's like a Simpsons thingy. It's funny. I think day before yesterday I saw on CNN an article saying that somebody was fired for showing Simpsons movie in the class in a school. So I'm a little worried about actually giving this as a homework. Let's hope for the best. Anyway, there is no coding involved, but it makes you think about modeling issues in writing the network. Okay, and in doing this, you may wind up doing the homework for the problems on homework 4 are also available, and then actually there are two problems. The first problem again actually is a big base network problem on Springfield again, Simpson story. So this is not exactly the same as the other one, except for the fact that the characters are the same. The numbers might be different, the story might be different, but this you do the inference also. Okay, in the homework you actually show how you that you know how to compute the numbers. Okay, in the project you mostly spend time writing the network. The network can be more complex in the project. Okay, here I make the network simpler so that you can do inference by hand. Okay, so this and that together are sort of a package, so you may as well do both of them together. Okay, and again, as I said, you could almost think of the project 3 as a big homework question or a really small project. Okay, there's no actual coding involved. And then, there are some other problems. There's one more problem I put in there. That one is just given this network configuration, which of these conditional independences hold? So, for example, for this to hold, there must be a certain conditional independence that you must be able to show in the network. Okay. So again, that makes you think about that. Okay. Um, So that's that. And then midterm is on next class. So as I said, everything on midterm basically is everything that we have covered in the homeworks 1, 2, and 3, for which now you have done them. You also have the solutions online. And so you essentially have all the information you need. Okay. So the one other question is, optionally, I'm happy to show up and have a review session sometime tomorrow evening if there is enough interest. Okay. But I have to admit that review sessions that I teach are not going to be, I'm not going to just go through all the slides again. All I'm going to say is, what questions do you have? And if you have questions, I'll answer them. Okay. Except you could do it as an extra office hours, or we can actually find a room and then people can ask questions. Other people can also hear the answers. So most likely the timing for this is going to be tomorrow evening around 4 o'clock. I need to actually figure out a room. But if there is going to be a review session tomorrow, how many people would be interested in attending? Okay. I will send you an email with the room and the time. Just watch that, okay? Of course, you can show up for my office hours today, and also generally I should be around tomorrow most of the day when I'm in meetings, but you can come by and ask me questions too. Okay. Any other questions before we do the discussion on Bayes network inference? Okay. So what I'm going to do today is, we spent a lot of time talking about how to write networks and conditional independence assertions hold in the various Bayes network configurations and so on. So the question, of course, the thing that we will do today is, how do you go about computing probabilistic queries in Bayes networks? Okay, you already know one answer, okay, which is, a Bayes network corresponds to a unique joint distribution. So if you are ever in doubt, you can always compile the Bayes network back into its joint distribution, and you can answer every query. That much is for sure, right? You should never have any question about that. There is no magic here. All you're going to do is hopefully try to do the inference without unfolding the entire joint distribution. Okay, so you should always know that there's nothing worse, if you forgot about everything else, you can always go from Bayes network to the joint distribution, and from there you can answer any query. Right? That much is for sure. Okay. And these queries essentially can be queries of any form, essentially any query over the joint distribution, okay? For example, I can ask a marginal query, P of A. Suppose I have a Bayes network of, let's say, burglary, earthquake, alarm, John calls, Mary calls. That's one network we know, right? So I can ask queries of the form, what is the prior probability of alarm going off? Okay. I can ask the query, what is the probability that burglary occurred given John called? Okay. I can ask the query, for example, these are the usual types of queries. Okay. So this is, all of these are computing posterior distribution. Okay. Typically over single variables. Okay, so the query variable here is B. I'm trying to figure out what is the posterior distribution of B given that I know John has called. Okay. Now if I don't know John called, I already have a distribution of B, which is a prior distribution. Right? And then you when John called, in essence, the inference essentially converts the prior distribution into the posterior distribution. Okay, and the posterior distribution essentially. So the simplest queries that you typically think of are single query variable given a bunch of evidence. But that's by no means the only queries you're interested in. Okay, you can also ask queries which are in essence conjunctive. Okay, we can also ask queries of the type, what is the probability, what's the probability of burglary earthquake given John Carl's miracle? Okay, now in essence what I'm doing is I'm actually computing the posterior distribution over two variables. Okay, it is different from computing posterior distribution over just B and posterior distribution over just E. Okay, because in particular what we're doing is we're computing the joint over a subset of the variables. Okay, and those, when you normally ask that, so these are essentially called map queries.
Is that commonly AND or OR?
Which one?
If you were to read that,
that means it's AND normally.
Okay.
Yeah. If you put a comma, it's an AND. Okay. In general, the version of this query that you would be interested in is, given the evidence, what is the most likely configuration of the network as a whole? Okay, notice that your world contains 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 variables. In any particular instance, these variables have exact true false values. Okay, without telling you, I'll tell you. So basically, I told you, by the way, John called. So what do you think is the most likely values of B, E, A, and M together? Okay, that might be a reasonable question. In essence, what we are saying then is, I am trying to compute, I'll get that. I'm trying to compute the joint distribution of P, B, E, J, M given, I'm sorry, B, E, A, M, given J. And having computed that, essentially pick the value that has the highest, pick the entry that has the highest value. Because notice that there are four variables here, right? So they can have 16 configurations. They have four Boolean variables, they have 16 configurations. I want to know which is the configuration that has the highest probability. And that's the most likely version. Okay? And those are called, that kind of a query is quite useful. That kind of a query is quite useful many a time, and those are called MPE queries, most probable explanation. Given the evidence, this is the most probable explanation of how the rest of the world was. Okay, the cute thing is most probable explanation is a joint query. Okay, so in particular, the most probable value of B given J may well be different from the most probable value of B, E, A, M given J. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you only given J, and if all I'm asking is what's the most likely value of B, you might say B is true. But the specific joint value of B, E, A, M for which this number is the highest might actually involve B being false. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so another way of thinking about it is that I have, let's say, multi-valued variables. I have a variable X which can take which can take values A and B. Variable Y which can take values C and D. Okay, and given some evidence variable E, the most likely value of A may be A. Most likely value of X might be A, Y might be C. And yet, the most likely configuration of X and Y together is B and D. Okay? And this is very much possible. And so the question is, it depends on whether you are interested in figuring out X and Y together or whether you're interested in just figuring out one at a time. You know where this is actually very useful? We'll see later on that when I'm talking right now in my own inimitable accent and you're trying to figure out what each of the words are in the sentence I'm doing, okay? As soon as you're doing segmentation and you're trying to recognize the words to make up the entire sentence, okay? The first word that I said might have sounded like the, okay? The most likely interpretation of that might be the. Okay, but then the second word, the most likely interpretation of it in isolation might be some other word. But then those two together make no sense. Nobody in their right mind would say those two words together. So then you would realize that although each of those words in isolation sound different, look like they are going to be word one and word two separately, if you have to look at them together, the most likely explanation of what Ravi is saying is he's saying word four here and word five here. Okay, we do this in speech recognition, for example. Okay, so those kinds of scenarios we wind up computing most probable explanation. Okay, that's another type of a query. And as I said, the one interesting thing about most probable explanation, and we won't go into it in too much detail, we'll see in today's class that in computing the normal queries of the type, you know, P, B given J, okay, what will be involved is you essentially marginalize a joint over multiple hidden variables. So B given J, now you have to marginalize A, E, and M out. The way you marginalize them is you sum them out. You'll see this in a minute. Okay. In computing these kind of queries, you sum, whereas in computing the MPE queries, you do maxes. You do maximizations in individual steps, but we won't go into that. Okay, we will see a very well-known example of this in temporal-based networks. Okay, called Viterbi algorithm, which essentially does exactly what I told you, which is if I tell you a bunch of words, you're trying to figure out jointly what is the most likely four words Rao just said. Rather than what's the most likely first word Rao said, what's the most likely second word Rao said. Because you don't care about individual likelihoods of the individual words. You want to know what's the most likely four words I said. And we use this actually to make up for failure in communication, right? If the phone line is noisy or if the speaker has a nice thick accent, you make up for what you lose on one word from what you gained on the other word to compute the actual most likely configuration. Okay? So anyway, that involves maximization in individual steps, but we won't talk about that. Mostly I will focus on the simple queries of this type. Query variable given evidence for now. Okay? So these basically contain summation normally. These normally contain maximization operations. These called map queries are of the following type where B and E given J and M. There still is a missing variable. So you have to sum over the missing variable, maximize over the query variable. Okay? And the map queries are kind of, they involve both sums and maximization. Okay? One thing we will hopefully do is sometimes certain types of improvements in algorithms are possible if you happen to know that you're doing maximization as against summation. Okay, remember this, we might wind up doing at some point of time game tree search and alpha beta pruning. And alpha beta pruning only works when you have minimization and maximization together. Okay. That said, so the individual algorithm details might depend on whether you're doing MPE versus MAP. Normally, it's understood that these are easier to compute. These are harder to compute. Okay. We are mostly considering single variable, so we are computing mostly posterior distributions today. That's what we'll be looking at. Okay. The rest of these things here, the optimal decisions, value of information, etc., these three really are, why are you computing these numbers? You are computing them to then combine them with some utilities to make some decisions. So forget about that part. So the most important thing, I probably should redo this slide, the three types are these queries, these queries, these queries. of which we will look at these. Okay? Question? Yes?
So how do you know the most likely assignment for the hit variable? Are you just supposed to kind of iterate over that?
No, for the for what? For which one? The MPE or the map?
MPE, yeah.
Let me get to that when I do that, you'll see. Okay. But in general, if you are in doubt, one way of thinking about it, as I said, is this is a question, right? Compute the entire posterior per BEAM variable given J. Okay? And pick the row which corresponds to the highest number. The question, of course, again, is can you do it more efficiently without computing the combinations of BEAMs that are going to have lower values anyway? Okay, so at least one way of going forward is to know that when in doubt, I at least know how to do it in an inefficient way. Okay, this you know how to do it this now. In fact, if I tell you how to do this, you know how to do this, it turns out. The question is, there may be even better ways of doing this than what you would have understood today. It's an additional efficiency consideration. We'll hopefully talk about Viterbi algorithm, which exactly does that. For temporal based network. Other questions? Okay. So those are the kinds of queries, and mostly I will be looking at just simple queries of the type query given evidence variable. And now, what is the complexity of these? First of all, there is like tons and tons of approaches for computing posterior distributions over Bayes networks. There are books written on them. Okay, this is, for example, one book that hasn't yet come out. That's one. Okay, that's mostly about just computing Bayes network inference algorithms. So that's an interesting area in itself. What I want you to understand today is that there are two general ideas. One is, of course, exact inference, computing the exact number for the query. Okay, the other is approximate inference, which essentially tries to compute the number that I'm interested in by doing a whole bunch of samples and numerator by denominator for the sample. Okay? It turns out that in exact inference, of course, the complexity of exact inference is not going to be less than the complexity of propositional inference, because in fact, this is it's more general than propositional inference. Okay, so in general, it's NP-hard. In fact, it's sharply complete because you wind up counting the models in this case. Okay, however, there are special cases, just as you have special cases for logical inference, which are polynomial. For example, everything that can be derived only by modus ponens can be derived in polynomial time, for example, right? It turns out that in the case of Bayes networks, the issue becomes one of the topology of the network. And if the topology of the network is a singly connected tree, which I call a singly connected network or polytrees, a singly connected network is a network where given any pair of variables, there is only a single path between them. There's only a single path between them. Okay, so here, okay, which of these are singly connected, which of these are not singly connected?
First two
are singly connected. Okay, in particular, this is our happy burglary example, right? Burglary, earthquake, alarm, John calls, Mary calls. It's a singly connected network because given any two variables, there is only one path between them. It's not exactly a tree, okay? That's why you call them polytrees. And what happens is, for polytrees, there are efficient algorithms that can be run in polynomial time to answer queries. Okay? And this, of course, is also a case of polytree. It's even simpler case. Any tree is a singly connected network. Any line graph is a singly connected network. Even this is a singly connected network. This, on the other hand, isn't. Okay? This has, if you ignore the directionality, there is a loop in this network. So that's the way to see whether or not the network is singly connected. If you ignore directionality, there will be a loop. If you consider directionality, there cannot be a loop in any Bayes network, because causation cannot be circular. Okay. So what happens in this case? So if you want to understand what this might be, cloudy wet grass rain sprinklers. That's the network now, okay? So cloudiness affects whether sprinklers are going to come on and whether it's going to rain or not. And either sprinkler or rain will make grass wet. Now this was the kind of case where if you're not careful, because the grass is wet, you start thinking it is raining, but then you made the grass wet by putting on the sprinkler. So there is a causal circle there. Okay. This particular network actually is the canonical example of a bad network. In the sense, in this network, it will actually be exponential time to compute probabilities. Okay. Now, here is an interesting question. Is there any way I can make this network a polytree? I'll tell you one way, okay? Combine these two nodes, okay? Then I will say cloudy followed by sprinkler rain followed by wet grass. What did I do? Right now this is a new node which just combined two previous nodes. Okay, it merged two variables. It's called a super variable now. It's a sprinkler rain variable. Okay, sprinkler rain variable. So cloudy still takes true false. Wet grass still takes true false as its values. Sprinkler rain variable takes true true, true false false as its values. If you do this, then you have essentially a singly connected network. Okay? Yes. On this network now, you can do exact inference in polynomial time. On this, you can't do it in polynomial time. Did I just prove P equal to NP? Yes, you had a question.
So they're not fully
invariable. Yes. So what do I give up? So I just basically said on these kinds of networks, you cannot do inference in polynomial time because it's not singly connected. But I showed you that I can combine this into a singly, I convert into a singly connected network by node merging. Then I can do it in polynomial time. Okay? So if I do have a polynomial time exact inference algorithm for singly connected networks, I can take many networks and make them singly connected by just combining certain variables together. Yes? No, yeah, more importantly, this is an exponential blow up. This, basically the number of values of this particular variable is going to be exponential in the number of nodes that you combined. Okay, so you did not gain anything. You didn't lose anything, you didn't gain anything either. It's just that, see, one important thing for those of you who understand the notions of NP hardness results, NP complete and NP hardness results, is NP completeness and NP hardness, etc., are essentially results on the input size. If the time you take is going to be a polynomial function of the input size, then your polynomial computation. If it is an exponential function of the input size, then you are more likely to be an NP hard computation. Okay, but what I can do is I can take the input, which is compressed, and expand it. So it becomes exponentially large. And then do only polynomial time on this exponentially large computation. So am I polynomial computation? Yes, for the bigger input, I'm polynomial. But for its more natural representation, which is the compressed version, I'm still exponential. Okay, so it is worth understanding that when I say something is exponential, it's all with respect to the size of the input. And when I converted this network to this network, I increased the size. I increase the size because this is now exponentially larger in terms of the CPTs and so on. Other question? Or any question? Yes.
Why back? You said that this one is not good in the policy.
No. So you, again, the basic point is, you know, basic, you know already, right, that probabilistic inference cannot be polynomial. Okay, so there should be some bad egg in the probabilistic inference. And I showed you two good eggs, this and this are good. So there must be a bad one. Okay, all I'm saying is all the bad ones wind up having cycles. Now, why is that? In essence, it's sort of related to the sort of thing why resolution is hard while modus ponens is not. Case analysis. Okay. But that's an intuitive explanation. That's not any formal thing. Okay. Okay, so any questions? Okay, so the idea here is that I combine variables to make it singly connected and then I can still do exact inference algorithms. Okay. But the question still is, how do I do inference on these or any of these? The variable elimination algorithm that you all read and that I'm going to discuss in a minute essentially will work for any of them. It doesn't say, is it singly connected or multiply connected. Okay? If it is singly connected, it just winds up being polynomial without you actually asking it to be polynomial. Okay? If it is multiply connected, it winds up being exponential in those cases. Okay? So that's a good thing to do. So, you know, an algorithm which, you know, automatically exploits the structure. That's what you'll end up doing. Okay. We'll look at, for exact inference, enumeration approaches, which is essentially going from the network to the full joint distribution and then from there computing what you want. And then do an idea called variable elimination, which is a caching idea, which basically avoids repeated computation. Okay. And then that's the only ones we will look at. But there are like lots of other algorithms that can be, you know, that have been developed. Okay, these two are good enough to understand from our perspective. And then we look at approximate inference, where one idea is the following. If I, let's say I am in this burglary earthquake world, okay, and you ask me what is the probability that burglary occurred given John called. One way you could do this is to say, to heck with this network, I don't need it, okay? I'll just spend time standing in Los Angeles doing a whole bunch of experiments, okay? In one experiment, and in every experiment where John did call, I go and check whether burglary occurred. So the number of times John called is in the denominator, and the number of times of those in which burglary occurred is in the numerator. So P of B and J by P of J is the number you need. That's it. Okay, you can always compute these numbers just by doing experimentation. The interesting thing is, rather than actually going to the physical world and do experimentation, I can use my Bayes network to generate the samples. Each experiment is a sample. Okay, we'll essentially see that rather than actually go to Los Angeles, you can use the network to generate the sample. And for every sample you generate, if J is true in that, then you count it one for the denominator. And if it also has B true in it, you count it one for the numerator. Okay? Suppose I did 100 samples I generated using this network. Okay? 18 of them had J true. Of those 18, 4 of them also had B true. Then 4 over 18 is my number. And this will become closer and closer to the real number if I increase the number of samples. Okay? So actually the approximate inference algorithms are much easier to understand because it's all generating samples. And generating samples is tossing coins, tossing biased coins, as we'll see. Okay? But on the other hand, these wind up actually being the only useful, only reasonable algorithms when you are stuck with very large networks. Okay, yes?
How is the basic network is
we'll see that. That's the only question you're going to keep in mind. I mean, when we get to the production of the samples, I will show you how to do it, essentially. But, you know, since you asked, I'll show you now. So when I'm generating a sample in this thing, for example, so I need to find a full sample is B, E, A, J, and M, right? Full sample requires the value for B, E, A, and J, and M. That will be one full sample. So first I have to generate a value for B. Now suppose I do have probability of B. Let's say it's 0.3. So I get a nice coin which gives heads 30% of the time, tails 70% of the time, and I toss it. Exactly. So in each of these cases, I do an actual coin toss. Okay. So basically, I'll get a coin which is 30% heads, 70% tails. Toss it, and if it comes heads, then I'll say burglary. If it comes tails, I'll say not burglary. Same thing here. Okay. Let's say this is 0.6. Then I mean maybe hopefully 0.01. Then you get a coin with 0.01 probability of coming heads, and I toss it. And if it comes heads, then earthquake happened. If it comes tails, earthquake didn't happen. Now, suppose after these two coins were done, I have burglary true and earthquake false. Now I have constructed a sample which has B already true, E false. Now I compute the value of A, the sample for A. Now I know in the Bayes network, there is a nice little thing telling me A given B and E. So in fact, I from that conditional probability table, I just need the row corresponding to when burglary is true and earthquake is false, what is the probability of alarm happening? That may be, let's say, 0.3, let's say. So now I again get a coin, which is 0.3 heads, 30% heads, 70% tails, toss it. So I do 5 coin tosses, and I'm done. And any time, the way the conditional probability tables are taking part in this computation, is exactly by looking at the conditional probability table. Okay? Since I actually looked at that, let me change the order and do this. Okay, so let's do this first because I don't have to repeat it then.
You need CB and PE, but in the actual sampling case, you don't need CB and PE, right?
Which one?
Probability of burglary and probability of escape you need here.
Yeah.
Bayes network, but in the actual sampling case, you don't need CB and.
Yeah, but the point is, would you rather go into Los Angeles and do experiments? And that's a waste of your life. I mean, if you are ready to do that, you don't need courses, right? You have to see this as a huge advantage. If you don't see it, I mean, you don't need probabilities if you're going to actually count. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying?
But even the PB and PE are done, you get the figures by actual sampling itself.
I understand. But now I already gave it to you.
Okay.
Why would you want to ignore it? See, giving the Bayes network configuration should mean something. If the guy with the network is still in Los Angeles downtown doing experiments, just like the guy who doesn't have the network, then what's the difference between them? You can sit in your home, right, and do this entire sampling. That's the beauty of it. Okay? Okay, so this is essentially what I'm saying, that sampling methods could in general be used even when you don't know the Bayes net, because you can just make lots and lots of samples if you can generate them. But unfortunately, you can't actually generate. How exactly do you generate a sample for burglary and earthquake in Los Angeles? You don't generate. You just have to sit and wait for John to call. And when John calls, check to see whether earthquake happened, burglary happened, and alarm was going off. And then you have one sample. Sampling is painful, my friend. That's why you get, you give money to all these Gallup organizations, etc. Have you ever, those of you who get painful calls dinner time saying we would like your vote on the following issue. You know, these are people who've been paid to sample. And are we nice to them? Well, at least I'm not, you know. Right? So it's a painful thing, and they're on phone, and if they actually come and say, we would like to see what happens to your home when earthquake occurs, we would like to sample, you know, imagine the amount of interest I'll show. Okay? So it's you convert real world experiments into simulations in the network. That's the beauty of this. Okay. So the sampling method could always be used, but now the samples are being generated from the network configuration. That's what you're doing. Okay. And this is what I was telling you. So consider this network. This is a bad network, right? Big bad network, which is the one with, loops. But I don't care. It's a Bayes network. So I start in the topological configuration, in the order, topological order. Okay. Start with cloudy. Okay. In a acyclic DAG, I'm sorry, DAG, I'm sorry, in a directed acyclic graph, there must be nodes which don't have parents. Yes? If everybody has parents, then there must be a cycle, right? So you start some guys like this guy who doesn't have any parent, okay? And then he has a prior number. Prior probability of it being cloudy apparently is 0.5. This must be in London, okay? So then you get a coin and which is 50% heads, 50% tails, and toss it. And if it comes heads, in this case it came heads, so now I know that my sample is cloudy. Okay? Then, now since this is cloudy, sprinkler is going to be, the probability of sprinkler depends upon cloudy being true. So the only number I care about is 0.10. So now I get a coin which is 10% heads, 90% tails. Okay. By the way, do people know how to do these experiments in computer? You don't actually need to make a coin. You don't have to go to Franklin Mint and ask for a coin, right? So the idea is essentially to compute 30%, to compute a coin toss which is 30% heads. All I need to do is I need a random number generator, which can generate numbers between 0 and 1. Okay. If it is less than 30, it's heads. If it is more than 30, it's tails. So if it's less than 0.3, it's heads. It's more than 0.3, it is tails. That's all. Do you understand now? That's your coin. Okay, you generate the random number between 0 and 1 and check if it is less than 0.3, in which case it is heads. So it's a successful sample. Successful experiment, if not, it's tails. Yes?
So you said whether the sample is actually very much the real world sample, like in the real world, probably this might not be the sample.
No, if you see, here is the deal. If you spend time constructing this, this is your real world. There is no point constructing models of the world if you are paranoid, thinking, I don't really believe my model. Do you understand what I'm saying? If I think that the world works this way and I wrote a model for myself, I can't keep checking, constantly. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm wrong. If I'm shown to be wrong, I should change my model. But until I'm shown to be wrong, I have to assume my model is correct. That's the whole point of models. Otherwise, you don't really believe in your model. Okay, so you're just dependent on the real world. Okay, so then you get a sprinkler, 0.10 probability, and then suppose you toss the coin. Not surprisingly, in this case, it came tails. So sprinkler is not true. Okay. Now the important thing is you must toss the coin. You cannot just say it's 0.1, so I'll assume it's negative. I'll assume false is the answer. You actually have to do the tossing, and the tossing is being done by generating a random number and checking whether it's below that number. Okay. Then for the rain, it's 0.8, and so I do a coin, and then this became green in this case. Yes? What? Yeah, but I mean, we have random number generator calls in every language.
Right.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's just checking. All I'm saying is, if I know that, so I basically generate, in Lisp essentially it becomes, so let's say P is the probability of true, then I'm checking if less than rand P, then true, else false. That's it.
And the whole idea is that you're going to process a large number of times the whole problem.
Yes, I'm telling you how to generate a sample. That's all. And if you have to generate multiple of them. Okay. So then rain, and then at this point, now I have both sprinkler and rain already. And so sprinkler is false, rain is true. False, true. The wet grass is 0.9 probability. According to this, I'm not making this up. This is your network. Okay. So I toss my coin, and it turned out in this case wet grass was true. So I have now generated a single sample C, not S, R, W. Okay, and I can generate 100 of these samples. Now, if I want to compute what's the probability of cloudy being true given wet grass is true, then of those 100 samples, only take the samples where wet grass is actually true. That would become the denominator. And the numerator would be of those, how many of them have cloudy true. That becomes a numerator. You got the number. Okay? So I am basically showing you here some network, two samples. And once I compute the samples, in essence, I basically, the funny thing is we had some joint distribution of these variables. And you represented them by this network. And computing samples from the network is essentially recomputing the joint distribution. Right? If I have these kinds of numbers, then I can actually, if I have a million of these samples, and I want to know what's the number for C, not S, R, W, which would be one of the entries in the joint distribution. I take million as the denominator, and the number of ones where all these variables have these values as the numerator. Okay. So, of course, if I just want likelihood, I mean, if I just want what's the probability, in this case, what I want to do is what's the probability, let's say, of, where am I? Yeah. Suppose I want to compute the probability of, what am I computing here? Rain given sprinkler is true. That's what I want to compute. Probability of rain given sprinkler is true. So I generate 100 samples, and let's assume 27 samples in that have sprinkler true, and 8 have rain true. 8 of those 27 have rain true. Then 8 by 27 is the probability that I'm looking for. And I can also compute the actual distribution also, which is 8 by 27 and 19 by 27 is the full distribution. Yes. Exactly, exactly. But it's also, this is like a no-brainer, right? I mean, imagine if I tell you, you know, you get to write an algorithm for variable elimination. Project 3.1 is going to ask you, either write a variable elimination algorithm or write this. Which one would you rather write? This, because this is just a bunch of tosses, and the computer, you know, generates lots of samples and takes numerator by denominator. Easier. Now, what gives? I mean, why should people learn exact methods if this is good enough? What gives, of course, is sampling-based methods are not going to be accurate unless you have large number of samples. The, in particular, what is going to happen is the following question. Suppose I'm trying to compute the probability in a medical scenario, the probability that the tip of the nose would be red, given you have anthrax poisoning. That's the probability I want to compute. So all I need to do is generate a whole bunch of samples which have anthrax poisoning and see how many of them have tip of nose red. To the extent anthrax poisoning is a very rare case, most of your samples won't have anthrax poisoning to be true. That's the whole point. I mean, in fact, if this network is you know, representative of the world, and if this has some anthrax poisoning in it, then it better be the case that the probabilities corresponding to anthrax poisoning true are going to be very low. Okay, so there are going to be very few samples where anthrax poisoning is going to be true. But it may still be the case that when anthrax poisoning is true, nose being red is 1, or maybe 0.9. Okay? And what would happen is you would not get enough samples. So you would never get an accurate number. Okay? If the evidence is very unlikely, then when you are generating samples, most samples would be inconsistent with the evidence. And so that all that work is wasted effort. Okay? More interestingly, think of what a pain this is if you have a huge network, some variables, and then, you know, some 15,000 layers later is some evidence variables, topologically sorted. Right? Now, this you know, this variable is true, this is false, and you're trying to compute the posterior of this node. The way you generate the samples, you would carefully generate everything up to here, then find, yep, it's no good because it's not consistent with the evidence. So you throw it out. Okay? Remember the issue here was we generated 100 samples. Only 27 samples had sprinkler true. And that of those 27, 8 had rain true. So the numbers that you are computing were only based on 8 and 27, not on 100. Okay? And what if, in fact, the, you know, you're trying to do this Bayes network is actually compute, I mean, this Bayes network is for, what's this, Bedouins in Libyan desert. Okay? So there too, causality works this way. Assume they have sprinklers too. Except most of the time, rain doesn't happen. Okay? And so what happens is the number of samples where rain true is going to be even much less, I mean, sprinklers true is going to be, I mean, so in this particular case, imagine that the sprinklers are broken or they don't, the water supply is very low or something. So the number of times when the sprinklers are actually happening is much less than 27. And so the number of samples are going to be bad. Okay? So in sampling-based methods, the issue is to increase the samples that are consistent with the evidence. Okay? If you really want to figure out how many people with what fraction of people with anthrax will have red noses, you should go to NIH Anthrax Poisoning Bureau, where they'll put all the people who have been poisoned with anthrax in one room, and you just go and check how many of them have red noses. If you start standing in the middle of Tempe downtown and look for people, none of them have anthrax. So even if they have red noses, they don't count. They're just sunburnt. Okay? So how do we get samples that are consistent with the evidence? That's the next big point. That's basically likelihood weighting. And this idea is, again, not that hard. All we're going to do is we're going to, suppose I know that I'm trying to figure out some probability given sprinkler and wet grass are true. Imagine probability of rain given sprinkler is true and wet grass is true. Let's say that's what I'm trying to compute. Okay. Now, I know that sprinkler and wet grass are true. So what I would like to do is clamp them to true. I don't let the sample change their value. And if the sample wants them to have a different value, then in essence what I'll try to do, as you'll see in a minute, is rather than have sample, so the way the previous example works, the previous slide once worked here, is that given a sample, sample one, either it is one consistent with the evidence or zero consistent with the evidence. So either it's a sample or it's not a sample. I mean, either it's a good sample or it's a bad sample. There's no in between. What I would like to do is to have fractional samples. This is a one consistent sample. This is a 0.7 consistent sample. This is 0.3 consistent sample. Okay? And so what I would do is, suppose I have three samples, one is consistent, one is 0.7 consistent, one is 0.3 consistent, okay? And then of those, this one actually has rain true and this one has rain false and rain false. Then in essence, the denominator is now going to be 1 plus 0.7 plus 0.3 instead of just being 1. And the numerator is going to be 0.7 times, so the numerator is going to be just 0.7. That's what we want to do. So of course fractions, you can have 0.7 by 0.9 and that can still be, and 0.7 by 1.7 and that can still be a probability. Okay, so the question of course is, how do I compute the, how do I give the fractional values to the samples? And the idea there is what I'm going to explain. You just give them fractional values based on the CPT tables, and I'll show you in a minute. Okay, in the beginning, before I start, so each sample has a weight. The weight is 1 in the beginning. And as I want the sample to have certain values without actually tossing the coin, then its weight goes down. Okay? In the beginning, the weight is 1, and I want to compute a sample. Now, I did a toss of the coin. Cloudy came true. Okay? So my sample now has cloudy true, and the weight is still 1 because I did not do anything illegal. I actually tossed the coin. Now I am about to sample sprinkler. But wait, I don't want to sample sprinkler. I want sprinkler to be true. Okay? Now, the question is, if I must have sprinkler to be true, its weight has to be 0.1. Because if cloudy is true, sprinkler will be true with only 0.1 probability. So I would take sprinkler to be true without actually tossing the coin, but then I multiply the weight by 1 times 0.1 because I took liberties with my sample. Okay? And then I come to rain. In the case of rain, I essentially actually tossed the coin with a 0.8 probability and it came true. So now up to now, cloudy true, rain true, sprinkler false, and the weight is only 1.0 times 0.1 times 1.0 again. Okay? Now I get to wet grass. Now wet grass, I don't really want to sample. I want it to be true. Okay? So when will the wet grass be true? What is the probability that wet grass is true given sprinkler is true and rain is true? 0.99. So I multiply this by 0.99. So 1 times 0.1 times 0.99. So my current sample is 0.099 good. And it's a good sample because by definition it already agrees with my evidence. Okay? So this guy will give 0.099 to the denominator, and it'll also give 0.099 to the numerator if in fact, you know, let's say my query is on rain and rain must be true. Yes, sir?
You multiply by 1 for rain.
What? Yeah, but multiplying by 1, yes, that's true. I mean, in general, you start with the default value to be 1, for the weight to be 1, and you only multiply when you are not sampling. Okay? Now, this looks like a very small change to the algorithm. I mean, if you could write the previous one, you could write this. Right? But it's going to increase the convergence rate significantly. So the number of samples you needed to generate to get the correct probability, suppose you know what the correct probability is, the number of samples you needed to generate to get the correct probability in the previous case might be, let's say, 1 million, whereas this may be only 100,000. In sampling-based methods, the game is to get the right number with the fewest samples, because then you do less amount of work. Okay? So this is called likelihood weighting, and you know it works like this exactly. Okay. Now, of course, there is an interesting question here as to how do you actually show that this would be a consistent estimate? And you know, basically, I won't discuss that. You know, you can, if you're interested, you can read in the textbook as to why, in fact, you know, this playing with samples as if they are 0.099 good, and taking these samples. How do you show that as limit n tends to infinity, the probability that you compute this way is actually going to be the true probability? Okay, that's a deeper question. I'm not going to discuss that here. But the textbook does have a reasonable explanation of that. Okay, question?
Since we are not sampling this graph, so why are we have multiplied 0.992 since we haven't?
No, because I did not want. So the point is, sample is a real sample only if you toss a coin everywhere. Think about it this way. If you're generating a sample on a four-node network, you must toss 4 coins. Every time you don't toss a coin, I slap your wrist. And that wrist slapping is this number. Okay? That's exactly what's happening. And every time I slap a wrist, your weight goes down. It starts at 1 and it's being multiplied by a probability which is less than 1 always. Okay? But you should be happy because your friend would not get any wrist slapping but would basically generate this sample and might find that it actually doesn't count at all because, I mean, generate a sample that won't count at all because either sprinkler or wet grass are not true. And so it's not actually consistent with the evidence. Yes? No, these numbers, where are these numbers coming from? They're coming from the CPT tables. Yeah, so here is the idea. That's what I was saying. So suppose I'm trying to compute probability A true given B true, okay? And I have the following samples, A, B, not C, A, B, C, not A, B, not C, okay? And these happen to have, based on my weighting, numbers 0.7, 0.3, 0.1, let's say. Then I know that I essentially, my number of samples, all these samples must be consistent with the evidence because I would never generate a sample which is not consistent with the evidence. So the total number of samples I have is 0.7 plus 0.3 plus 0.1, which is 1.1. And I want to compute the probability where A is true. What's the probability of A being true? A is true in this and this sample. So 0.7 plus 0.3. So 1 by 1.1 is the probability. And as you increase the number of samples, I have bigger, you know, better and better estimations of denominator and numerator. Okay? Now, the likelihood weighting example is better than the rejection sampling, where you just reject a sample because it's not consistent with the evidence. But even it is not particularly great because what happens, again, as I said, if you have multiple layers, here is a variable that you're trying to query over, and the evidence is way down here, okay, by the time you come here, everybody else have taken the values that are most likely for them. And the evidence variable probably is very unlikely given what you have wound up taking in all those places. So then the sample will have a non-zero value, but it might be like point, you know, 1 times 10 power minus 12 is its value. So it's not going to be very good. But it's better than the rejection sampling approach. Okay, there is, these are the two is, you know, reasonable methods that you can yourself understand here. There are much more interesting methods actually on sampling based approaches, which we won't go into. Okay. The other thing that I want to mention, and obviously I have to complete it by when we come back next time, is the exact methods. Especially since you already read them. Maybe we can just complete it because you already read them. Okay. So in the case of exact methods, all you are doing is computing the joint distribution to answer the query. Okay. Suppose I'm trying to compute in this network probability of burglary given John and Mary. Okay. The capital letters means I need the distribution. Small letters means they have that value. John called and Mary called. Evidence always has a value, and query variable you normally want to compute the distribution, not just the value, not just, you know, B equal to true. Okay. So then this would be, you know, using conditional probability definition is the probability BJM by P of JM, which would be, you know that if you compute P of B as well as B equal to true as well as B equal to false, then I don't need to compute P of JM, right? This much you remember from the normalization ideas. So ultimately the story is this will be nothing but some normalization constant alpha times probability of B, J, and M together. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is that you, to compute this, you need to sum over the hidden variables. Okay, the variables that are not mentioned are E and A. So you have to sum over E and A. Okay, and so the P of B, E, A, J, M for different values of E and A. And if you're trying to compute B equal to true, you then just take all the entries where B equal to true, E can be true or false, A can be true or false, J must be true, M must be true. Look up those entries in the probability table, add them up. And do the same thing with B equal to false. And then those two numbers can then be normalized to get the joint distribution. Okay? Now the question of course is this, now the whole point of this is B, E, A, J, M can be written as P of B times P of E times P of A given B, E times P of J given A times P of M given A. That's the whole point, right? Because this joint distribution number can be written as B of B, I'm sorry, P of B, P of E, P of A given B, E, P of J, A, P of M, A. That's what I wrote there is just the way you compute the joint distribution, joint entry, given the conditional independences that hold in the Bayes network. Okay, now, so basically you don't actually have a big table anywhere, you just multiply these numbers out to generate the entry in the table as needed. Okay, now we can do another thing, which is rather than sum over E and A outside, you can take the summations inside. So for example, only this, this and this depend upon the value of A. So I put this summation here and then put this summation over both of these. If you do this, essentially this is the normal brute force approach, slightly better than the normal brute force approach for enumerating the joint. Okay, and it's sort of a it will take exponential time for any, you know, query. Okay, now the point to understand here is look at this particular expression here which I put there. Okay, so if you are essentially computing one of the entries for, you know, probability of B equal to true, let's say, then you are doing this computation. Okay, you're multiplying M of A times J of A, multiplying J of not A, M of not A, adding them, and then multiplying it by P of E, then multiplying it by P of B, that would give you one number. I'm sorry, actually on the other side, you have to do the opposite. Okay, now the problem is that you can see this number G of A and M of A is being multiplied again here. So we now are actually doing what computer science algorithms people are supposed to do. Forget about all the probabilities, etc. Just avoid multiplication. You know, if you multiplied once, don't multiply again, because that's one way of saving time. Okay, so you multiplied here and you're going to multiply here. What if I multiplied here and remembered this? Then that intermediate result can be looked up when I come here. That's all I want to say. Variable elimination algorithm is essentially a way of remembering intermediate results such that they won't be recomputed in every branch. It's as simple as that. Yes, sir?
So if you're doing it in Lisp, you could just put the calculation itself in an auxiliary function that would first look it up and then try.
Yes. Okay, so the question of course is formally you can think of these intermediate functions that you are computing and storing somewhere essentially as what are called factors. Okay, so here I write this P of B given JM, basically I just wrote this expression from previous time. Okay, what I'm going to do is assume that, so this thing depends only on the value of M. And this depends on the value of J, this depends on the value of A. And then you multiply all of these, the thing that comes out only depends on the value of J and M because A got out. Then you sum over. Okay? So what I'm going to be doing is for each of these intermediate, this actually is actually already can be looked up from the CPT. But when you multiply them, that would be a new table that you're generating. Okay, and then you just store it, intermediates, okay, so that you can get the numbers for that from that. Once you multiply it, you then look it up, second time around. Okay, So when you are here, so for example, so you called this, so what we are calling is this is f, a factor of m, this is factor of j, this is factor of a, and then since I am summing over a, then a essentially goes out, and then I have under, and then some, this factor now depends on the new factor p of e times this whole thing depends on this factor table times this factor table. Okay, so think of it as you're generating intermediate lookup tables. Yes. No, the, these factors are actually multiplicate the what do you mean edges or. No, I don't think so. I have to think about it. All this one is doing is, this is essentially memoization. You know, you're remembering what multiplications you did. Okay. So anytime I'm looking for a number, you know, a factor, if it's already present, then I just look it up. If not, I generate it and store it. So if somebody else comes to look for that same number, they'll find it because I stored it. Okay. This essentially trades space for time. You store intermediate results, so you take more space, but then you avoid remultiplying. Okay? One issue that you want to understand is what does it mean to multiply two factors? So if you have a factor on A and B and a factor on B and C, then the way you multiply them is like a join operation, for those of you who know databases. Okay, so essentially this, so for example, for ABC true, 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 I take true, true from here, true, true from here, I'm sorry, and then multiply them, 0.3 times 0.2. And similarly, false, true, true, I take false, true from here, true, true from here, 0.9 times 0.2, 0.18. Okay, so all variable elimination is essentially remembering these intermediate results so that you don't have to recompute them. Okay, now the interesting thing is even if the network is actually a chain or a polytree, this first inference by enumeration algorithm takes exponential time. Whereas this variable elimination algorithm will take polynomial time. In general, what happens is the complexity of the variable elimination algorithm depends on what is the biggest factor you generated. And a factor is big if it depends on multiple variables. The more variables it depends on, the bigger it is, because it's going to take exponential configuration in the values of those variables. Okay? Now, what happens is that for networks, and then the complexity of variable elimination depends on the size of the largest factor, which in turn depends on the topology of the network and the order in which you remove the variables. Now, in general, you always remove the variables in the topological order, because that's how, you know, if you notice, that's essentially what you did. You M and J, and then A was removed, then you removed E, because A was topologically inferior to E. Okay? Now, what happens is, for singly connected networks, if you do in topological order, you can be sure that your size of your largest factor will not be exponentially large. Okay, so the total amount of time you spend can be shown to be polynomial. For multiply connected networks, basically the factor sizes can be exponentially large. So that's, somebody was asking, how do you know that multiply connected networks will become hard? From the point of view of variable elimination algorithm, the factor sizes increase. Now it turns out that even for multiply connected networks, there are good orders and bad orders. Okay, even within topological order, you know, if you have, for example, this, if you have, for example, you know, a random network with too many, something like this, there is still a, you know, causality. What is the order you should remove the variables? It turns out that there are optimal orders for removing the variables, and finding the optimal order is NP-complete. But if you find the optimal order, then that is the lowest amount of time work you would do. Okay, and there are, you know, I won't go into this, but there are some beautiful ideas called tree width, which can be thought weakly as what is the largest, what is the smallest set of variables that you have to combine. Remember I said if you have a network like this, you can make this singly connected by merging these. Then I would say this is almost a tree, but it has width 2. Normally tree has a width 1. Real tree has a width 1. To make this into a tree, you have to take 2 nodes and combine them. So its width is 2. The cost of the variable elimination algorithm winds up depending on the tree width of a Bayes network. And finding the optimal tree width is NP-complete. Okay, so it's a beautiful theory, but all you need to know is from this point of view, from our class's point of view, variable elimination is remembering multiplications that you have already done so that you don't redo them. And you do this in a sort of a dynamic programming fashion. So factors depend on factors. Okay, so I have an exact algorithm, I have an approximate algorithm. I have a set of approximate algorithms for inference. I have two exact algorithms for inference, two approximate algorithms for inference. You can use either of them to compute the probability. Okay? We'll stop here.